Exodus, chapters 21, 22, and 23. The 23rd talk in a series on Exodus was presented by David Crabtree on July 13, 1997, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 1997. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
We're back to Genesis. I'm going to do three chapters this week in summary fashion rather than going through verse by verse. Two weeks ago I talked about the Ten Commandments. Those were the commandments that were given by God at Mount Sinai directly to the people of Israel. His voice spoke from the cloud. At the conclusion of giving those Ten Commandments, the people said, no, no more. It was too intimidating for the people to hear directly from God. And so God instructed Moses to come up the mountain, and God delivered this next group of commandments to Moses to then convey to the people of Israel. And it's that second group of commandments then that I'm going to talk about today. So today I'm going to talk about the law proper, some of the details of the law. Now the law is presented, there's one version of it here, and then it's given an expanded form, portions of it in Leviticus and then in Deuteronomy. This is a shorter form than what you see in Deuteronomy, and the stuff that's repeated in Leviticus is yet to come in Exodus. But when I think of the law, it always seems to me that that is a boring topic. Reading through the Old Testament, this is a section that I generally either skipped or skimmed. It's boring and kind of tedious, and at least it seems that way. And yet I was reading in Umberto Casuto's commentary as he was coming up to the presentation of the law. He makes the statement, now we come to the highlight of the book, the high point of the book. He says it's the most sublime section of the whole book. And then he's going to talk about the law. Somehow it doesn't seem like it fits. And yet, as I was thinking about this, there is something sublime about it. And I'm going to try to persuade you today that there is a sublimity to the law that is presented here. In looking at these laws, it's difficult to know why these laws are in here and why they're in the order that they're presented. What is it that God is trying to do in the presentation of these laws? The reason that's puzzling is because if I were to do it, what I would do is I would take each of the Ten Commandments and elaborate on them and try to go into greater detail on exactly what each one of them meant. That's not what we have here. And so it's difficult to sort out what is going on here. What is included here and why is it included? What is God trying to do? He isn't elaborating on the whole law. It's just bits and pieces that he elaborates on. And why is that happening? The most sensible explanation of that comes from Umberto Casuto, my favorite. What he points out is this section, it is not a comprehensive explication of what is in the law. And that's pretty clear. Secondly, it is not what we think of as case law. Case law is a term that is used to refer to our legal tradition, the Anglo-Saxon legal tradition, in which we have basic principles laid out, and then there are exemplary cases in which those principles were applied. And you can see from the way they were applied in these various situations more clearly what the principle means and what it does not mean, what it includes and what it does not include. And that's called case law. It's a way of elaborating on the law, on the principles of the law. Umberto Casuto says this is not case law. This doesn't fit the category. It's not what we think of when we think of case law. So what is it? And he suggests that what we have here is an assumption that the people of Israel shared a common understanding of right and wrong that they adopted from their society. That there existed standards of right and wrong within Egypt and within the ancient Near East that were, for the most part, common to all of the cultures. And what we have here is changes, either amendments to that existing societal standard, or new significance given to that societal standard, or affirmation of elements of that societal standard. So all this is saying, you know what you think of when you think of right and wrong. Now, keep these things in mind. Some of those need to be adjusted. Some of those need to be thought of a little bit differently. And some of those are right on. And that's what we've got in these next three chapters, according to Casuto. Okay, what I would like to do is to just go through and summarize some of the high points of the law that's presented in these three chapters. And it falls into, there's different topics that are covered, and it skips from one topic to another. Exactly why the order in which the topics are presented is not clear to me. Casuto says it's for, the order is dictated by the language. I won't get into that, but I don't know why the order is the one that it is. The first thing that he talks about, however, is slavery. And what he impresses upon the people is the need for a humane kind of slavery. First of all, slavery is for Hebrews. And remember, Hebrews is not the same as Israelite. A Hebrew is a social category. And it's interesting that he uses the term Hebrew here. Hebrew is the social group that included the descendants of Abraham. They were a kind of marginalized, nationless people that moved from one place to another. The thing that comes to my mind when I hear the ancient term Hebrew is gypsy. It's more of a social category than it is an ethnic group. And the Israelites were a part of that category. And he says that you will only have Hebrew slaves for 6 years. There is a limit to how long you can be a slave as a Hebrew. 6 years, and after 6 years, that person is to be let go. So slavery is limited in time by this restriction. In general, a slave who is married, when that slave is freed, his wife goes with him. So there is an attempt to keep the family unit together. Now I say that, and yet there is one verse here that seems to contradict that, and that is a little bit puzzling to me. It is chapter 21, verse 6. I'll start with 5. No, 4. If his master gives him a wife, and she bears him sons or daughters, the wife and her children shall belong to her master, and he shall go out alone. So, in the case in which someone becomes a slave and the master provides a wife for that slave, then when he goes free, the wife and the children stay with the master. That strikes me as odd and rather inconsistent with some other principles that we see in the law. And I don't know why this provision is here, and why it would not be that the wife and the children would go with the freed male slave. However, it goes on to make provision for the man and his wife to stay together. It says, "But if the slave plainly says, 'I love my master, my wife, and my children, I will not go out as a free man,' then his master shall bring him to God. Then he shall bring him to the door of the door or the doorpost, and his master shall pierce his ear with an awl, and he shall serve him permanently." So there is a provision here for the man to stay together with his wife and his children. And we have here the institution of ear piercing. So, but in general then, and I suspect that there is a reason for this one provision that seems strange to me, in general the tenor is slavery needs to be humane. Limited in time by 6 years, and an attempt to keep the family together. The next topic is capital offenses for which murder, for which the death penalty is given. And in each of these cases, it is crime against a fellow man. The first one is premeditated murder. For that, the murderer is to be put to death. And then it points out, if the crime is accidental, then the death penalty is not to be instituted. And the provision that's made here is that the one who kills the other one, the one who is responsible for, the one who brings about the death of the other one accidentally, he can flee to a city of refuge and be safe there. The second is the striking of a parent. If a child strikes his parent, then he is to be put to death. The third is kidnapping. If someone kidnaps someone else, the kidnapper is to be put to death. So those are three crimes against a fellow man and crimes for which the death penalty is prescribed. The next set of laws deal with injuries that result from one person striking another person. If someone strikes another person and that second person is injured as a result, then the one who struck him has to do two things. One is pay for any time missed from work, presumably, that the amount of time that that person is bedridden and cannot work, then the one who is responsible for the injuries has to pay for that time. And the second provision is more curious. He is supposed to take care of him while he is recovering from his injuries. So the one responsible for the injuries then is required to take care of that injured person until he recovers from his injuries. An interesting way of impressing upon the one who committed the injuries the pain and the suffering that was induced by that act. If a slave is injured by a master punishing him, it says there will be no punishment because the slave belongs to the master, unless the slave dies. If the slave dies, then the master is to be punished. That's another interesting feature here. I think the institution of slavery is so repugnant to us, at least in my thinking it is, that it's difficult to, think about these laws fairly. I am not a proponent of slavery, but I know from my studies that slavery is not a wholly destructive institution. There have been times when, for instance, when in Russian history, the peasants were enserfed. 90 some percent of the population was was serfs, essentially slaves. And then in 1861, they were released from serfdom. And there were a number of serfs who protested when they were released from serfdom, from slavery. And you think, well, that's ridiculous. What are they? Is this like masochistic or something? But one feature of being a slave is you are valuable to someone. And someone has it in their own self-interest to take care of your well-being. And there were some really nasty aspects to slavery and serfdom, but in some cases it was not a bad arrangement. And when these serfs were freed and turned out on their own, in Russia at least, for many of them, conditions got worse, not better. Because as a serf, your master would take care of you 12 months out of the year. When they were released from serfdom, they were hired out as wage laborers. So they would work during harvest time. But during the winter, they would receive no income. And they knew at the time of emancipation that things would probably be worse for them as freemen than things were as serfs. And in fact, it's been argued, and I think it's probably true, that serfdom ended in Russia when landowners discovered that it was economically advantageous to them to get rid of their serfs and just hire people in the summer. So there are some aspects to slavery or serfdom which, given a good master, it's not all that bad an arrangement. And it's not all that much different from some of our arrangements. But in any case, I think it's difficult, for me at least, to hear that in slavery, that it is advocated, it says here in the law, that if a master beats a slave, but not to death, then it's okay. I find that a little difficult. The third instance of injuries from striking is a pregnant woman. Here is one that you've probably heard talked about in conjunction with abortion. Here is an instance in which a pregnant woman somehow becomes involved in an altercation. And usually what they think is, the thinking is, you have two men fighting, and the wife of one of them steps in to try to break up the fight and ends up being injured herself. And it says that if there is a premature birth as a result of that, then the one who causes the injury is to be punished. Let me read that verse. This is verse 22 of chapter 21. And if men struggle with each other and strike a woman with child, so that she has a miscarriage, yet there is no further injury, he shall surely be fined as the woman's husband may demand of him, and he shall pay as the judges decide. But if there is any further injury, then you shall appoint as a penalty life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, bruise for bruise. I think that the translation here, miscarriage, is misleading. Because the only thing that seems to make sense here, and the Hebrew seems to be indicating this, is that if the man strikes the woman and causes a premature birth, not a miscarriage in the sense of a premature birth to a dead fetus, but rather a premature birth of a live child, that if it brings about a premature birth of a live child, then there is no further injury, he shall surely be fined as the woman's husband may demand of him, and he shall pay as the judges decide. In other words, he could have done really serious injury. As a result, he will be fined for that act, even though the child has lived. But if there is further injury, then eye for eye, tooth for tooth, etc., etc. So that makes more sense to me, that that's probably what it's talking about. That if it induces a premature birth, there will be a penalty that he has to pay. But if there is further injury, then it will be meted out to him in proportion to the injury done. And we'll come back to the eye for an eye concept. The next topic that's taken up is the topic of negligence. Now, this is a little bit strange because he introduces a topic that doesn't seem to fit under the term of negligence right in the middle. But the negligence that he's talking about is if you have an ox and it gores someone else's animal, and if this ox is known for goring, then you are negligent and you need to pay restitution. If you dig a pit and you don't cover it up and an animal falls into it and is hurt, you have to pay restitution. Then there's another little section I'll come back to. If you are grazing someone else's field, you've rented it, you're grazing someone else's field and you overgraze it, then you are negligent and you have to pay damages. If you are burning and the fire gets away from you and burns someone else's field, then you have to pay restitution. If you've borrowed something and that thing is broken while you're using it, you have to pay the restitution. If you borrow something and it disappears, then you have to pay restitution. Now, if you borrow something, it goes in further detail. If you borrow something, like an animal, you've borrowed animals, or you're taking care of someone else's animals, and through no fault of your own, something happens to them, then you don't need to pay restitution. For instance, if animals come and tear them up, you don't have to pay restitution for that. So the concept here is negligence, something that you should have foreseen that you did not. Some risk that you took that was greater than you ought to have taken, then you have to pay restitution. You have to make up for the damage that was done to someone else, the injury that was suffered by someone else. Now, in the middle of this, it talks about theft. And I'm not sure why theft is inserted in the middle of this discussion of instances of negligence. But it says, if a thief is killed in the act of stealing, then the one who killed the thief is not to be punished for that. When a thief steals something, he has to pay back double. He pays back what he stole as well as a penalty on top of that. Or if it cannot be found, if he's already used it up, then he has to pay back multiple times. So he not only has to restore, but he has to go beyond that and pay a penalty for what he has done. The next topic is seduction. If a man seduces a woman, then a virgin, it's talking about a virgin. If an unmarried man seduces an unmarried woman, a virgin, they must marry. And he pays the dowry, unless the father of the woman decides that this would be a disastrous marriage. Then he pays her dowry, the girl's dowry, for her marriage to someone else. Then it talks about capital offenses against God. Before we had capital offenses against man, here it's against God. And the three are sorcery. If someone is a sorcerer or a sorceress, they are to be put to death. If someone commits bestiality, that person is to be put to death. If someone sacrifices to other gods, they're to be put to death. Then it gets into crimes for which society is not to enact any punishment. He warns the people of Israel to take care of the poor, the widows and the orphans, and the strangers, the aliens. And it tells the Israelites not to loan on interest to their brothers. Then a series of instructions about regarding respect for God, again with no penalty by society. It says, do not curse God or the king. We've seen elsewhere where that's essentially the same in God's mind. When the people were complaining to Moses, God essentially said to them, you aren't fooling me, you're complaining against me. You're not complaining against Moses. You're not grumbling about Moses, you're grumbling about me. And God seems to have this perspective that this cursing the king is cursing God. So it warns against that. Do not curse God or the king. Give the firstborn, dedicate the firstborn to God. Thirdly, do not eat animals killed in the field, that is, by torn apart by wild beasts in the field. Do not eat carrion, because you are a holy people, is the reason that it gives. And then it goes into some detail saying, do not subvert justice. Do not lie. Do not just follow the crowd when the crowd is doing something wrong. Do not pick on the rich. Do not pick on your enemy. Do not subvert justice in order to get back at your enemy. Do not accept bribes. Give foreigners their due justice. And then it says, remember every seventh year to let your fields lie fallow. A principle that was established in Israel by God is that every seventh year the people were to not work their fields. I assume this is where the term sabbatical comes from. Every seventh year they would not work their fields. Just allow whatever grows to grow. Well, what will grow will be the fields, the plants that you've been planting in those fields over the last few years. They'll come up as volunteer crops. But you are not to work them. So there's no sowing that takes place. There's no tilling that takes place. It just comes up out of its own accord. And the reason for this, apparently, is that the land may rest, and more importantly, that the people may rest. That's talking about the slaves and the hired hands. That they will not have to, and the animals, they will not have to work on that seventh year. And they can harvest what they need from the volunteer fields to live on. But they are not to cultivate them. And then the last thing that he talks about is that they ought not worship other gods. It talks about three feasts that they are to celebrate. All of these feasts were apparently feasts that the Canaanites celebrated. A feast at the time of harvest, a feast at the time of... the Feast of Ingathering, and the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Apparently, the Canaanites, where they were going, celebrated all three of these same feasts. But God is giving them a different significance. Essentially, these are to be feasts in celebration of God, of Yahweh. And they are cautioned not to confuse the two. That these feasts are to be in honor of God rather than the Canaanite gods. So he cautions them not to sacrifice as the Canaanites sacrifice on those holidays. Okay, that is in very summary form what these three chapters say. And I encourage you to look at them, read through them. My suspicion is that some of the things that seem really mysterious, if we knew more about the culture, would be less strange. Okay, I just want to make some observations now in general on these laws. First of all, it does prescribe capital punishment, and we have a debate in our time of whether capital punishment deters crime or not, and there are people who argue that it does, and there are people who argue that it doesn't. Whether it does or it doesn't, even though I'm convinced that it does, I mean, if I've worked with juvenile delinquents. I worked for a year as a counselor in a medium security institution in Washington for juvenile delinquents. And I'm convinced that there is an awful lot of calculating that goes on in their minds before they commit the acts that they commit in a lot of cases. Some of them are truly impetuous. Some of these boys that I worked with were extremely impulsive and really at the mercy of their passions. But to a large extent, what they did was very calculated. And some of them spent a lot of time talking to the attorneys from legal services to find out exactly what they could do and what they couldn't do. And they knew the laws better than I did. And they would choose their actions on the basis of what they knew they could get away with and what they couldn't get away with. So I think that capital punishment does indeed deter. But in any case, it eliminates. But if someone has committed a capital crime and they are put to death, then it removes that person from society. So in that sense, it clearly deters. So God does not seem to shy away from capital punishment. In fact, it is required in instances that seem to us rather severe. For instance, a child striking a parent. And it says the death penalty. That seems awfully severe on the one hand. But on the other hand, it really does uphold authority. It really does firmly establish that there is authority in society and you do not violate that authority. Something that I think in our day and age has been largely lost sight of. The second thing I'd like to comment on, this concept of an eye for an eye. There is in the law a notion that a crime committed incurs a debt. And that debt is twofold. The debt is, in a sense, to the one injured. And so in many cases, restitution is what is appropriate. But there is also a debt to justice. So, for instance, when a thief steals something, not only does he return what he has stolen, that doesn't make things even. Because that criminal has done an injustice to justice. That criminal has violated the justice in society as a whole and must pay an additional debt. So an eye for an eye is the sense that there's a debt that has to be paid, and that this debt has to be paid in proportion to the crime. Some crimes are just more destructive than others. The more destructive the crime, the more serious the penalty has to be. What is interesting to me in this law is there's no sense of trying to get the criminal to admit to wrongdoing. There's no provision here for someone who says they're sorry. In our thinking, that should mitigate the penalty. If the person is truly sorry for what they've done, then the penalty should be less. There's no hint here that that's what God is indicating. A certain crime, a certain penalty, regardless of how they feel about that crime. It's a curious feature. It had never occurred to me until recently. I heard on the news a comment about our prison systems. They're called penitentiaries. The thinking being penitence. The thinking being that these are institutions in which a person, penance, a person will begin to feel sorry for what they have done. They're trying to force a person to admit to wrongdoing. And the Old Testament law is not taking that approach. The Old Testament is saying, you commit a certain crime, you suffer a certain penalty. Done deal. A third thing I'd like to comment on. There are no victimless crimes here. We have a developing concept in our society. It's been developing for a period of time, but it's becoming more and more pronounced, I think, in our day. And that is that there are certain crimes that are non-crimes. If a crime is committed, if something that we consider wrong is done behind closed doors and everyone involved is consents to it, then it's not a crime. So victimless crimes is the term that's sometimes used. And yet, here in the Old Testament law, sorcery, bestiality, what was the other one, are all capital punishments, and yet it seems to us that those would fit the category of victimless crimes. I think that we in our day and age have a mistaken concept about how crimes affect the rest of society. If no one else is directly harmed by the act, then no crime has been committed. It seems to me that what this is indicating, what the Old Testament is indicating, is that some things are wrong. They are acts of rebellion against God, and they cannot help but influence and have a detrimental effect on the rest of society. When we do something, commit an act of rebellion against God, we essentially become a different person. We see that with Adam and Eve after they've eaten from the fruit. They are changed people as a result of that. They sense nakedness after that. Before that, they're naked, but they don't sense it. After they've committed their act of rebellion, they sense their nakedness. They are changed people. I think we get the same idea from Cain. Cain is a changed person after he kills his brother. There's a real sense of defiance and anger in him that's related in the narrative. I remember a quote from C.S. Lewis. Unfortunately, I don't remember it exactly. But he makes the comment that if we could only see people as God sees people, what we would see is that day by day, we, the people around them, are either contributing to them becoming more like glorious beings, that if we could see them for who they really are, we would want to bow down and worship them. Or they are becoming more like demons from which we would run in terror. And what he's capturing there is our souls are being shaped and transformed day by day by the way that that person responds to God and the way that we encourage them to respond towards God. I think that when someone commits an act of rebellion behind closed doors, they come out from behind those closed doors a changed person. They come out more beast-like, more demon-like than they went in. And that cannot help but have an impact on society as they go out. So there are no victimless crimes. If it is truly an act of rebellion against God, it will have an impact on that person's soul, and that person's soul will have an impact on society. The fourth thing that is interesting here to me is that societies, or Israeli society, Israelite society, was not instructed to punish all wrongdoing. There are certain evil acts that are described in here, acts against, for instance, not taking care of the poor and the widows and the orphans, not taking care of the strangers, offering sacrifices to other gods. There are several things in here that it does not prescribe a punishment for. And I think that that's indicating that societies ought not attempt to deal with all wrongdoing. There are some kinds of wrongdoing that are too subtle for society to handle, that we need to leave that up to God. The fifth thing, and this was one of the more interesting components of the law here, is the solution that the Old Testament is presenting to class conflict. Now, class conflict is a concept that has been brought into our society, is really central to our thinking, whether you are well-versed in Marxist theory or not. I'm sure it has affected your thinking because it's so pervasive in our atmosphere. The understanding is that much of the suffering that occurs in our society, this is the understanding of our day and age, much of the suffering that occurs in our society is a result of inequality. Inequality of money, but more importantly, inequality of power. And so the solution to many of society's problems is to empower the have-nots. If the have-nots were more powerful and could stand up for themselves and could have self-respect and all that sort of thing, then societal problems would disappear. So we need to equip them to fight on an even playing field with the haves. Okay, so we need power to empower. We need to find power to empower these have-nots. Where do we get that power? Well, we need to have economic and political leveling. We have to take from those who have and distribute it to those who have not. How can we do that? We need to involve the state. I mean, who else can do that? So we need to involve the state in this Robin Hood kind of activity of distributing more evenly power and money across the board. So that's the kind of solution that's advocated in our day and age. And the consequences are that it encourages an adversarial relationship between the haves and the have-nots. The haves see the have-nots as just wanting to get what they have and have rightly earned. The have-nots are encouraged to see themselves as victims and see themselves as having a rightful claim to what the haves have. As a consequence, then, what happens? The state grows and becomes more pervasive in our affairs. So justice, then, is seen to be a matter of equitable power distribution. That's what justice is. Justice is fairness, in that sense. What we see in the law here is a different concept, a different notion of justice. What it's advocating is that those who have see it as their own individual responsibility to look out for the have-nots, the strangers, the widows, and the orphans. So it's encouraging a sense of camaraderie rather than alienation and antagonism. On the other hand, the have-nots are warned not to look for opportunities to stick it to the haves. So it guards against antagonism. So here the emphasis is not on what society needs to do, but rather on what the individual needs to do to dissipate the potential for class conflict. So it diffuses social tension rather than encouraging it. So justice here is not equal distribution. Justice is respect for God-given principles. It's a whole different concept of justice. And it encourages people to be content with God's allocation of resources and status, respect for God's principles of right and wrong, and concern for rightness rather than equity. What's curious about this is the Old Testament solution, it's much more satisfying on the one hand, but on the other hand, it requires that we have this concept that God is taking care of us. Ultimately, whether we are shortchanged or not is in God's hands, and we don't have to make sure that we don't get shortchanged. Okay, those are my observations of things that come out in the law that are curious and worth consideration. Now, coming back to the question, is the law sublime? Something that I have noticed as I have been leading discussions with children on the Old Testament narratives. We started in Genesis, and we finished 2 Kings this last spring. If there's one topic that children, even at a very young age, are always eager to talk about, it's justice. It's a topic that they're intensely interested in. What's fair? What's right? What's right treatment? And what's wrong treatment? And the nuances with which they're willing to deal with those topics is phenomenal. And their facility with arguing both sides of an issue is also remarkable. But what has struck me is their intense interest in justice itself, just that topic. I think we are all intensely interested in the topic of justice. It is inherently important to us. I think that the concept of justice is built into us, much like the concept of beauty. Some things are more beautiful than other things, and we sense that. Some things are more just than other things, and we sense that similarly. It's built into the universe and it's built into us. And when we see something that is truly just, I think it resonates with us, much like beauty resonates with us. And there is something about the way that the principles are elaborated here in the law that, for the most part, and I say for the most part because there are some verses here that are puzzling to me and bothering, but for the most part it resonates with that sense of justice, I think. For instance, there's no confusion as to whence crime. We are often told in our day and age that crime is the result of environmental factors, the way a person is raised, societal factors, that they can't help themselves, or that it's likened unto a disease and needs to be treated. But I think the Old Testament law is taking the perspective it arises from evil hearts. And the appeal is, don't do it. And if you do it, you will be punished. The sense that crime incurs some kind of debt, and that debt must be paid each time, every time the crime is committed. The crime is serious and affects all of society. It can't be ignored. And it insists that every individual must see it as his own responsibility to have justice rule in his actions and in his heart. And finally, that the state must be kept within certain parameters. The state is only supposed to punish certain kinds of crimes, and beyond that, it has no business going. Those things, it seems to me, resonate with our sense of justice. That there's something right about that. That there's something very simple and proper about the way these principles are laid out. And I would have to admit that it is a very refreshing antidote to the mess that we find ourselves in this society, in which justice is not carried out, justice is not honored. And there have been some prominent court cases, legal cases in recent times that I think have violated our sense of justice. And in fact, if I were charged with a crime for which I was not guilty, I would be fearful going before a jury of my peers, because I know that the legal system is more a game than it is a true implementation of justice. And I would be fearful of the result. So there's something really refreshing about a simple elaboration of principles that line up with the sense of justice that I think is built into us. And in that sense, I think that the Old Testament law is truly sublime. There is a beauty there. And I think in its high points, that becomes very clear. And in the more obscure features, we have yet to work those out. Comments? Questions?
You've been talking about God is trying to set the Israelites apart, make them into a different people than they've been in Egypt. Do you have a sense whether the law, this law, was something that could have been accustomed to, or was it going to be different?
That they would have been accustomed to?
Yeah, in Egypt. Is this kind of, is it...
Well,
would you repeat the concept of the question?
Yes. I think what she's asking is this a bolt out of the blue? Is the law that's being presented here wholly different from what the Israelites have experienced before? This concept of right and wrong as they're spelled out here. Is this completely different, or is this very similar to the concept of right and wrong that they would have adopted in Israel as they, or I mean in Egypt as they grew up there? Is that the question?
Yeah, and with that, is was this, if it's different, was it there to set them apart?
Mm-hmm.
as a
group, right,
of people?
I'm inclined to think that Umberto Cassuto is right in his discussion at this particular point. This section of laws in this three chapters is, for the most part, God is assuming that they have absorbed the concept of right and wrong that they grew up with in Egypt, and that he is not going to change that wholesale, but rather he is just fine-tuning it. And it makes sense that the concept that they would have grown up with in Egypt would be largely right if it is true that this concept of justice is built into us. If it's true that it's built into us, then we would expect to see a lot of the same principles all over the world in every time. Some differences here and there, of course, but the basic principles we would see in every time and every place. And I think that that's what what God is drawing upon here, that he's saying, okay, you learn certain concepts of right and wrong in Egypt. Let's take that as a starting point. Now, I'm going to make some emendations to that. And he begins in the Ten Commandments, and in particular there talking about their relationship to God in the first five of the Ten Commandments. But in the second five of the Ten Commandments, he states those very briefly, and I think those would probably summarize fairly well the concept of right and wrong with respect to interpersonal relations as they were taught in Egypt. And he just makes some emendations to that in this three chapters. Now, he's going to go on and talk about the law with respect to religion and customs. And that's yet to come up in Exodus. And there, it's going to be quite different from what they learned in Egypt. And I think the emphasis there is on making them into a separate people with separate customs, distinct. But that's yet to come. In these three chapters, I think for the most part, it's dealing with interpersonal relations, and that he's just tweaking what they have already learned to be true in Egypt. Does that answer your question? Yes.
Kind of following that same line, the issue about the slavery, one where he's actually changing that maybe more significantly than just fine-tuning it, whereas there were slaves in Egypt and it was a long-term kind of basically lifetime thing since they were there so many years. And yet in Egypt, in the Promised Land, when they arrive there, it's going to be a different setup. And I don't know, does Casuto talk about the indentured servitude aspect?
No, hasn't come up in Exodus yet, so he hasn't talked about that.
Because I was thinking that was part of what to be freed, if you owe a debt and you work for so many years, 6 years, and then you paid off your debt. And even with the, whether or not you keep the wife, those situations, that if in the situation where you have to leave the wife with the master, the man would go out and he wouldn't be able to support his wife because he's just been paying all of his, money that he owed to the master, and so he could establish himself and then later on take the wife with him or something like that, take his wife with him. Casuto doesn't address that, or is that
no,
too?
This has not been addressed here, because here in Exodus all that's being talked about is slavery, not indentured servitude. And I think that what's happening here is, instead of God throwing out the whole institution of slavery, he's saying, okay, you know what slavery is, you were slaves. These are going to be the principles now. I'm not throwing out the institution, but there are going to be these things that are different about it from what you know. One is, it'll only last for 6 years. And we'll keep families together. And so I think that's what he's doing. Yes?
My religion teacher told me that in Jewish times, 99% of the time, the capital punishment was acceptable because it was swift and sure. They knew who did it. He argued nowadays that capital punishment is not acceptable because our judicial system is not swift, it is not sure, and there's so much media hype that you don't necessarily know if the person was guilty or not because there's so many different stories. I was just wondering what you had to say about that.
Well, I think it is true that modern society is significantly different than the Israelite society that we're talking about here was. Whether the difference is significant enough that it makes capital punishment no longer viable, I think is truly questionable.
Technical difficulties resulted in the loss of the remainder of this talk.